So we're joined today on Radio Not Bombs with Maurice Carney. He's the Executive Director of Friends of the Congo, and we're honored to have him here.
Yes, it's a pleasure being here with you.
Thanks. Well, first tell me a bit about what is the Friends of the Congo and what kind of work does it do?
Friends of the Congo is an advocacy organization. Basically, what we do is we raise awareness and mobilize support on behalf of the people of the Congo, and we've been doing that for a number of years. As you know, the Congo is going through a tremendous crisis at this time. In fact, for the last 10 years, Congo has been stated by the United Nations as the deadliest conflict since World War II, with 5.4 million people dying in the conflict since 1998. So we travel around the country and we engage people about the situation in the Congo and try and get them involved to make a difference with what's taking place there.
Why do you think there has been this level of media ignorance when it comes to the crisis in Congo?
Well, I'm not certain it's media ignorance. The Congolese say there's been a conspiracy of silence because there's so many vast corporate interests involved in the Congo. And that's been tied into governmental interests as well. Whether you're talking about the United States government, European government, Canadian government, they're all in cahoots with mining companies that are systematically looting the Congo, as Antonio Guterres of the United Nations Commission for Human Rights said in an interview that he gave to the Financial Times earlier this year.
Yeah. So there's vested interest in not talking about it.
Absolutely. 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 We'll just give you an example. United Nations has done a study from 2001 to 2003, where they identified mining companies that were illegally exploiting the mineral wealth of the Congo. One of those mining companies was Cabot. And Cabot, the former CEO of Cabot is Samuel Bodman. And Samuel Bodman is the Secretary of Energy in the Bush administration. That's just one example where you have government and corporate interests tied into what's going on in the Congo. You have a number of Canadian prime ministers, for example, Jean Chrétien and Joe Clark and Brian Mulroney, all working on behalf of mining companies that are illegally exploiting the mineral wealth of the Congo. So you have government officials at the highest level of government in the Canadian, American government, and even the European government. And then you have these major corporations put together their market cap. Most of them are publicly traded, add up to the hundreds of billions of dollars. So you have political interests and economic interests coming together to work against the interests of the Congolese people. So it's not in the best interest of the corporate media to expose these companies.
What strategies are Friends of the Congo employing to fight back against this within this own country?
Well, within the Congo itself, or here.
I'd like to talk both about
Certainly. Well, here, one of the key things that we say is we break the silence.
Yeah.
We're raising awareness. We're shining the light on the situation because much of this has been happening in the dark. It could only happen in the dark where you have 5.4 million people dead in 10 years. And of those 5.4 million, 2.7 million are children. And then you have hundreds of thousands of women violently raped, all in an attempt to get access to the mineral wealth of the Congo. So we say you have two rapes going on. You have the rape of the women on one hand and the rape of the land on the other hand. And the two are inextricably linked. They go hand in hand. So what we do is we raise awareness, let people know about it, because in order for people to undertake some kind of action, they have to be informed and educated. So we're in the process of informing and educating people so that they can take actions, and there are a number of actions that they can take, and we can get into that a little later.
In terms of what's going on right now in the Congo, can you give us a bit of the background of the situation on the ground right now?
Well, for all intents and purposes, the Congo is under tutelage. That is to say, the leaders that are in power right now are serving not in the interest of the Congolese people, but in the interest of external powers. So that is the framework in which one should look at the Congo today. And within that framework, what happens is the leader that's in power is Joseph Kabila, is the president of the country. What he's done is provided unfettered access to the mineral wealth of the Congo. And it is for this reason specifically that he was put in power. And in fact, the mining contracts that he's issued since he's been in power since 2001, international bodies such as the Carter Center have done a review of the contracts and say that almost all of the contracts work against the interests of the Congolese people. And these contracts should be either abolished altogether or be renegotiated. And that's one of the major battles that's taking place inside the country at this time. In addition to that, we still have conflict, particularly in the east of the country, where the International Rescue Committee said in a report in January that 45,000 people continue to die each month in the east of the country, all as a result of conflict in that part of the country, where it's enormously endowed in minerals such as gold and tin and coltan. And many of these minerals are central to the functioning of modern technology. Our cell phones, the natural resources, the coltan, for example, is critical to the function of our cell phones. The game consoles that our young children use, we're talking about the Sony PlayStation, Nintendo Wii, or even the Microsoft Xbox. Those are the resources that are used in those electronic devices come from the Congo.
Mm-hmm. Now, talking a bit more about your work here in the United States, and, mm-hmm. and before the interview, we were talking a bit about the charity framework for right. understanding the situation yes. broadly in yes. Africa without yes. even looking at the specifics.
Right.
How do you work in this action of raising awareness to work against the immediate tendency that I see in a lot of people mm-hmm. to immediately go into that charity framework to say, well, the issue is humanitarian aid.
Right.
The issue is more trips by Bono.
Right, you know? Right.
So can you talk a bit about that?
Sure. Well, that's a difficult, the charity obstacle is difficult to get over, you know, where we have a certain prism through which we view Africa. And it's understandable to a certain extent, because you have what we call the CNNization of Africa. That is to say, when Africa is presented in the mainstream media, it's either children with big bellies who are starving, so-called tribes that are wantonly killing each other. You see these negative pictures that really tear at your heart, so you want to help. But we need to look a little deeper and provide some kind of history and context when we view Africa. And when we look at Africa and see, look at it contextually, we notice that what happens is that you have humanitarian aid coming in through the front door, while you have billions and billions of dollars going through the back door in through mining concessions, oil, timber, you name it. The African continent is enormously endowed with mineral resources that can more than provide for the African people. It has tremendous agricultural land, arable land, that can more than feed the African people. So what we do, to answer your question specifically, is we go to campuses, speak to student groups, radio programs such as we're doing now, publications that we run from our website, every possible avenue that we can find, alternative channel. We maximize the use of those alternative channels to get the word out and put a framework out that presents Africa in a different view that hopefully will enable policymakers and also the average person to look at Africa differently.
Speaking a bit more about the domestic situation here, mm-hmm. Have any of the, you know, and this is a time of elections
yes.
here in the United States.
Yes.
And it is a time when people are more politicized, regardless of where that politicization is going, what direction it's going in.
Right.
Have any of the major candidates talked in a way that you find is responsible mm. and just about mm. this crisis particularly and the larger situation you're talking about?
Right.
On the continent?
That's an excellent question, because as you have the political campaigns taking place now, just recently in February, President Bush also made a five-nation tour of Africa. So Africa has been put on the front burner for a moment, so to speak. Now, when the candidates speak about Africa, they usually speak about Darfur, where you have 250,000 or 400,000 people have died as a result of conflict there. But they rarely speak about the Congo, where you have 5.4 million people who have died, and it's a tremendous crisis. Now, Barack Obama has said in the past, speaking specifically about the Congo, and he said that in order for Africa to achieve its promise, it's critical that we solve the problem of the Congo. And you have to understand why he would make a statement like that, because Congo itself sits in the heart of Africa, bordered by 9 other countries. It's the size of Western Europe. So it's really the fulcrum on which the African continent swings. So if the heart is well and good, then you're going to see a strong, vibrant Africa. But if the heart is under cardiac arrest, as the Congo is now, then it's going to restrict the development of the African continent. So the Congo is central to the development of Africa because of its size, because of its strategic locations, because of its enormous wealth, you know, with the diamonds and the gold, the copper, tin, cobalt, uranium, you name it. They have it in the Congo. It's the second largest rainforest in the world next to the Amazon, which is central to fighting or combating climate change. So it's very critical country, but it's not brought to the attention of the general public either through the campaigns or really in any other way. Even when President Bush made his trip to Africa, he had visited neighboring Rwanda, but said very little about the Congo and what the United Nations has called the deadliest conflict in the world since World War II.
And you mentioned briefly the conflict in Darfur,
yes,
which does get a tremendous amount of
Absolutely.
Publicity and traction within the United States.
Absolutely.
And on college campuses as well.
Absolutely.
I mean, I can speak from experience in seeing many hundreds of college students attend Save Darfur rallies,
right,
and put up signs like this. Why do you think this issue, and I don't want to necessarily put the issues side by side because they are their own completely separate contexts.
Right. Right.
But in talking particularly about this framework and talking about, you know, candidates and the African issues, yet why that issue? Why has that been so much?
Well, before I jump into that issue, just in looking at Africa, even though I speak about the Congo, as I said, Congo is the heart of Africa, and look at Africa as a body. You know, we're concerned with all the members of the body,
sure,
in all the countries. And in looking at Africa, we often look at it just by country, instead of looking at it regionally, because you know, Sudan borders the Congo. You know, so it's right next door. So, you know, if something is happening in Sudan, then and there's another thing happening in the Congo, we need to speak about both of them. Because interestingly enough, the principle upon which the Save Darfur movement is built and relies upon comes out of the UN Declaration of Human Rights. And that is the responsibility to protect the vulnerable. Now, that's a principle. Now, if that principle is at work in Sudan, it also ought to be at work in the Congo. It ought to be at work in Somalia. It ought to be at work everywhere. You know, as Martin Luther King said, injustice anywhere is a threat to justice everywhere. Mm-hmm. So with that framework, if we were to look at that framework, I think the Save Darfur movement would be broader in scope in the sense that it would at least say something about the other issues taking place on the African continent, but it focuses strictly on Darfur. And notice it says Save Darfur. It doesn't even speak about Sudan. So you're actually creating this area where you're really a region. You're actually elevating a region to the level of a country, in a sense, at least in the popular consciousness. Now, why the focus on Save Darfur? Why so much energy has been built around it? And why the mass media appeal? It's a result of a confluence of things. One, you have the Sudan civil war that had taken place for at least 30 years or so. And you had it was presented as the Northern Arab Muslims fighting against the Southerners, the Christian animist Africans. And you had the evangelical community long time involved in Sudan in terms of supporting people in the South. Now, when things broke out in Darfur, you had the evangelical community still engaged, because here it is again, you have these so-called Arabs, Muslims, attacking these Africans animists. At least, I'm not saying that's the way it is, I'm saying that's how it's been presented. And then it was elevated to the level of genocide. Now, because you're talking about genocide, that brings in the Jewish organizational interests that came into play. So here you have the Jewish organizational interest that has access to enormous resources. You have the Christian evangelicals that have been involved in a long time and have a friend in the house who's also an evangelical, born-again Christian, George Bush. So these three forces coming together to generate the necessary resources, especially financial resources. The Save Darfur movement has a budget of $15 million, an annual budget. They spend millions of dollars just on advertisement alone. So these are the confluences of forces that came together to push Darfur in the mass, throughout the mass population. And as a result of that, you also had the student population picking up on it. Naturally, because if you see people dying needlessly, you want to do something about it. So it was generated in that fashion. Unfortunately, that has not occurred around the Congo because, you know, the Congo doesn't have a quote unquote a Muslim enemy, right? The Arab enemy. And then an economic enemy in China, you know, where they focus on boycotting China or the Olympics. In the Congo, the enemies are much closer to home.
many of the discussions around these types of crises center on whether or not intervention, I mean military intervention, right, is a necessary or important step. When you speak of the Congo, is that what you're talking about, or is it a different kind of framework you're talking about when you're talking about pulling out of this crisis and seeking a new future?
You know, that's a difficult question on one hand, because the Congo, quote-unquote, has the largest United Nations troops. Right now, 17,000, 18,000. Even though, say, it's the largest, compared to the size of the country, it's barely enough. Let me put it that way. Liberia, which is much smaller than the Congo, had, you know, around the same number of troops there. So, and the United Nations has been, it's had mixed results. But on the, if you look at it, they've served a positive more so than a negative role. So to that, if you have international intervention or even African Union intervention, then that's fine. Because we've had examples throughout the continent where Nigeria and ECOMOG or African forces had intervened in Liberia, and that worked out well. So if it's homegrown intervention, I think you have that's a path that you can pursue, no doubt. But you had mentioned a second part of the question. I missed that.
Where that question fits generally into your long-term visions, I suppose, for how
right
can be
resolved. Right. No, it's not intervention. Resolving the crisis lies in a number of areas. One, impunity reigns throughout the Congo. That is to say, no one is being punished for the crimes that they're committing. So that has to be, a system has to be put in place so that people are punished for the crimes that they're committing, so that the population can get a sense of justice. Two, there has to be national reconciliation in the Congo, maybe something similar to what happened in South Africa, because so many atrocities have been committed and the country needs to heal. So national reconciliation is necessary. Three, foreign intervention has to be curbed. And when we talk about foreign intervention, we're talking about foreign governments, United States, Canada, European nations. We're talking about multinational corporations, such as some of the ones I've mentioned. If I haven't, Cabot Corporation, the OM Group out of Cleveland, Ohio, Freeport-McMoRan out of Arizona, corporations such as those, First Quantum out of Canada, Force International out of Belgium, H.C. Stark out of Germany, and here in the United States, these corporations are deeply involved in the Congo. So that has to be curbed as well. Third, the multilateral institutions. We're talking about the International Monetary Fund and the World Bank. You know, if you look at the Congo, it's a classic case of where you have Naomi Klein's shock doctrine actually meeting John Perkins' Confessions of an Economic Hitman. Because you have the United the IMF and the World Bank, International Monetary Fund, setting the laws, the economic laws, for the mining laws, for example, and the forestry laws, all set by the World Bank. And in addition to that, you have the International Monetary Fund. It's got an International Finance Corporation wing that's actually got investment in companies that are exploiting the natural resources of the Congo. So you see the collusion of these interests, foreign governments, multinational corporations, multilateral institutions, all in cahoots with local elites who are serving these foreign interests at the expense of the Congolese people. So these are the forces against which the Congolese people are fighting. And that's why Friends of the Congo has been engaged, because we want to establish a counterforce by reaching out to the average person on the street and having the average person, ordinary people, calling upon them to get engaged. Because when ordinary people get engaged, they can make extraordinary change with little effort, actually.
Thank you so much for this interview. It's been more than informative. And just finally, for folks who want to plug in and learn more about this, how can they find out more? Where can they get engaged?
Certainly, they can visit us online at friendsofthecongo.org. They can call us toll-free at 1-888-584-6510 and get involved. We have different levels of engagement. So if you just want to get involved by being at your computer, you can do that. If you want to visit us and work with us in D.C., you can do that. And if you want to go to the Congo and work on the ground, you can do that as well. So we have levels of engagement that everybody can participate in and help make a difference in the Congo.
Great. Thank you so much, Maurice.
All right. Thank you.